So I don't know about you, but I was a little bit surprised to actually realize that next week we have our exam.
Evil face.
So I sent out an email yesterday with the exam coverage, so at least I know what in principle we're going to cover. The drill will be the same as last time in terms of the formula sheet that you can bring in. Again, I will put a formula sheet on the exam with everything that I can think of that you need, and I will try to send that out to you early. It'll be basically from capacitance to the end of Ampere's law, which we do today. And okay, so that is what it is. It'll make for a fun weekend for us all, I imagine, a bit. Anyway, I do have a question for you. Would you rather have the Q&A session that I will try to set up on Tuesday evening, or Wednesday? All who want Tuesday? All who want Wednesday? Man, how predictable is that? Okay. Tuesday? I think the Tuesdays have it. Wednesday? All right. I'll aim for Tuesday. We'll see if I can get a room at a time that works. And I may put out a doodle poll to see if there's a preferred time, but we'll see what happens. Okay. So, any questions on exam two stuff? Not material, but the actual doing of the exam sort of thing. Oh, the other issue with this one that is different from last time is that we will have it during the common exam time. So it's at this annoyingly early hour of 8 a.m. and it'll be in Bausch & Lomb 109. That way we can actually have class that day too. Alright, so it'll be great. You can come in and look pretty zoned out in class, that's alright. Okay, so last time we talked about the law of Vo sub R, which is sort of like Coulomb's law for magnetism. And what we saw is for a discrete charge moving with some velocity V, you can determine the magnetic field at point P by this expression. Okay, so there's this constant mu 0 before pi, mu 0 is a constant called the constant of magnetic permeability in free space. And then you have Q, and V cross R gives you the direction of this magnetic field. And so it's always at some weird angle, so V cross R at point P, if Q is going this way, is going to be into the board. It falls off over as R squared. And of course, you won't actually use this all that often. So conceptually, I would understand it. You won't usually have to calculate anything with that. The form in which you'll usually have to calculate things will be like this, which would be more like the analog of the continuous charge distributions in Coulomb's law. In this case, you'll have some set of currents, and you then calculate it in much the same way we did with Coulomb's law, in the sense that you choose a little piece of the current and then set up the appropriate form of the differential piece of the magnetic field, and then sum over all the currents. So in this case, if I have a little IDL, a little current element here, the differential magnetic field at point P, which you can basically extract from this formula, becomes mu 0 over 4 pi times IDL cross R hat over R squared. And so you then want to sum all these differential dPs, basically summing over all the differential DLs, so all the currents. So you do an integral over the current distribution of this thing. So this is the thing you'll actually end up using most of the time. And just like with Coulomb's law, there will be certain geometries where this is reasonable for mere mortals to calculate the magnetic field, and there will be some geometries where it is probably impossible to calculate the magnetic field using this in a reasonable way. So one of the things you want to do when you're doing your homework problems is sort of step back and look at it in some systematic fashion so that it's easy for you to understand the geometries that are useful and some of the tricks that you have to use. So we did an example in the class last time with a circle, and then we looked a little bit at lines that feed into circular elements. And so those are geometries where they should jump out at you as something that you want to use this for. So if you look at the cross products and you think about it, you can come up with some simple rules that help you very quickly get directions when you're thinking about problems. And they all basically are right-hand rules of different forms, and they all basically come out of the cross product. So one of them is, if you grasp a line segment that's carrying a current with your thumb going in the direction of the positive current, your fingers will go around the field. If you look at Ampere's, if you look at Biot-Savart, will basically rotate around the wire. And to get the direction right, you look at how your fingers curl around the wire. So if there is a wire that's coming out at you, you can use Biot-Savart to realize that if your eye is coming out at you, I cross R over here is going to be up. I cross R over here is going to be down. And so you can see that it's a circulating magnetic field. If you grab a wire with your thumb in the direction of the current, your fingers will circulate in the direction of the field. If you have a circular current loop, it doesn't have to be circular. If you have just a current loop and you want to get a sense of the direction of the magnetic field in the vicinity of the current loop, you can imagine putting your fingers around the direction of the loop in the direction the current is going, and your thumb will then point in the direction of the magnetic field in the interior of that loop. So here, if you grab it, your fingers are going like so, and the magnetic field will be going into the board in the interior of the loop. Because the field basically circulates around and comes back, because you don't have a source of field, what you have is like a dipole situation where you have field lines that emanate from one place and come into another. If it is in here, it's going to be coming out over here. And again, you can use Biot-Savart to make yourself believe those little rules. And of course, if you use your left hand, they're all wrong. So pay some attention to that. You guys okay with that? All right. And I will give you some examples of this and expect you to just get it all, okay? So if you miss one of those, be ashamed. Don't be angry at me. It's coming. It's meant to be easy. Okay. So we have in electrostatics, if you recall, we calculated things with Coulomb's law and saw that sometimes it could be fairly difficult, even in situations with nice symmetry. And so we pulled out what's known as Gauss's law, which turns out to be really useful. It's a basic fundamental law of electricity, electromagnetism, where we look at the integral of the electric field dotted into the, we look at the flux, which is the total flux is equal to the total charge enclosed in the surface where you're calculating the flux divided by epsilon naught. And what we saw was that conceptually this is always true and sometimes even useful in just an arbitrary conceptual sense. But particularly, it's very useful if you have situations of symmetry where this integral and that are relatively easy to calculate. So in spherical symmetry, planar symmetry, cylindrical symmetry, very often you can invent Gauss's law surfaces where the electric field dotted into dA is either E times dA or zero, and If it's e times dA, e can pull out of the integral, and you just are integrating over this symmetrical surface area. And when you do that, if the symmetry is right, then this becomes a very useful law. So as you can imagine, with B O sub R, there are many instances where the current distributions are hard to calculate. But there is sort of an analog to Gauss's law in magnetism. And we call it magnetostatics, even though there is moving charge, because the currents are steady. And so the law that is useful in magnetostatics is called Ampere's law. And Ampere's law says that the integral of B dot dS, where dS is an element, a line element on a closed loop, so this is an integral around a closed curve, and that's equal to mu zero times the I enclosed, where I enclosed would be the current which basically penetrates through the closed curve. So the closed curve can have some arbitrary shape. It can have that arbitrary shape in three dimensions, if you wish, so it can be pretty strange curve. And if I have a current that passes through the surface that is subtended by the edge of that curve, then it is considered to be an enclosed current. It has a direction. You get to choose what you think is positive or not, if you wish. But a current flowing through the curve that way comes with one sign, and a current flowing through that way comes in with another sign. So it's a little like flux, okay, but it's a current density that passes through the surface. And so you take your closed loop, and you look at all the current that passes through each direction through that closed loop. You sum it up, and that's what goes here. And then you do the integral of V dot dS around this thing. So you pick each little line element of this, and you integrate all the way around, taking that component of the magnetic field that is parallel to that curve element as you integrate around the curve. So you are sort of summing up the components of B which are parallel to this curve as it goes around. Okay? It is very similar to Gauss's law in that sense that if everything is pretty arbitrary, this can be arbitrarily difficult and not particularly helpful. But if you choose the symmetry right, or if you have a situation that exhibits a certain type of symmetry, then it can become very, very useful and very easy to do. So let's look at a useful geometry. In particular, it's most common geometry that you'll see with Ampere's law problems are it's very useful for things with cylindrical symmetry, so wires and coaxial cables and things like that. So, let's imagine that I have an infinite line current. Then, if you look at the symmetry of this, so what you'd like to do is to find the magnetic field in all space. So, if you look at the symmetry of this, if we look at it along the axis of the wire, in the direction that the wire is flowing, the current would be a vector going into the board. And by symmetry and by B O sub R, we know that you would expect to see the magnetic field lines circulate. Probably should look more like a circle than that. Let me do it this way. So the magnetic field lines will will be coaxial to the wire, and they will circulate around in the direction given by the PS of R, and the intensity will fall off as 1 over R squared as you go. So just from the symmetry of the problem and knowing PS of R, you should see that that's the case. Okay. Now, PS of R is painful if you want to calculate the magnetic field, because you now have to sum over line elements of current that are going from minus infinity to infinity. Okay, I don't know how difficult it is, and maybe it's painful, but it seems painful. You start cleaning infinities and things, and it's painful. So let's just look at what happens with Ampere's law. So Ampere says that the integral of B dot ds around a loop is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. You say, what loop? Well, just like with Gauss's law, you get to choose the loop that you wish to do this law around. And if I choose some loop that looks like this, it's not going to help. Right? So, but if you take advantage of the symmetry of the problem, and we choose a loop which has, which is coaxial with the wire, and we will choose it at some arbitrary radius r. Okay. Now we know that around that loop, the magnetic field is all of the same magnitude because the loop is entirely the same distance away from the wire. And the other thing is, we know that the magnetic field is always going to be parallel to that loop, because of the circular cylindrical symmetry of the problem. So because of that, we know that B dot ds becomes B times ds, and B is a constant, and we're integrating from 0 to 2 pi r around the loop. So you can imagine having a little ds, and you'll have B here, and we'll just choose to sort of integrate ds around that way, so that B and ds are always in the same direction. So B dot ds is B times ds. B is a constant because it's at one fixed radius, and you just pull it out of the integral. So this becomes B times 2 pi r, and that's equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. And in this case, I enclosed is just I, because it all goes through the loop. So the magnitude of B is equal to mu 0 times I over 2 pi r. So the magnitude of B outside of the wire falls off as 1 over r. And the direction you have to get from your right-hand rule in BS of R. Okay, so it's very easy to do. So we'll do an example in a little while that's a bit more complicated, but if you see a problem that has an infinite cylindrical symmetry with currents in it, and you want to know something about magnetic field, if there's no angular dependence in that current, then you should think of doing it with Ampere's law. Okay, and just like with Gauss's law, the thing that can make the problem a little more difficult is if the charge distribution is varying as a function of R, or if, that's sort of the main thing. And so here it's similar in that we can distribute the current as a function of R in some arbitrary way, or not arbitrary, but it can be. So long as it has no angular dependence, but just radial dependence, then it means that when you figure out what I enclosed, you have to know where you are in R. So you basically, this becomes an integral of recurrent density. So we'll do an example in a few minutes. But that's the kind of thing that makes these a little bit harder to do sometimes. Still much easier to do than BO sub R. Now, if you recall, when we were doing electrostatics, we used Gauss's law to look at the field outside of an infinite plane. And out of that, we created something which was a fairly useful device, a capacitor, you know, and we created this sort of infinite plane capacitor, which gave us a very nice way of producing a uniform, useful electric field that we can use conceptually in a lot of ways. And that calculation is even true if you have two plates that are close to each other and you're looking at the field right in the middle. They look infinite, so it actually works pretty well. There's a similar thing that we want to do in magnetism, and just like where this model of the parallel plates became basically a good mental model for what a capacitor is, we're going to do a similar thing here with the solenoid for magnetism. So let's consider a solenoid, which basically you can think of as an infinite spring-like shape, or slinky, if you've had a slinky before. So the solenoid looks something like this. It's And we're going to imagine that we have a current that is coming in here, which is now going to be sort of behind the paper, circulates around, and is coming out over here. And we're going to assume that this is actually infinitely long. You okay with that? And what I'd like to do is to calculate the field of an infinite solenoid. So I'd like to calculate the magnetic field due to this particular beast. So a way to do that is to take advantage of the symmetry of the problem. And in this case, what I'd like to do is momentarily take our eyeballs and look at a slice of the situation that goes right down the middle of the solenoid. In other words, we take the solenoid and we lay it out right here, and we cut it right down the middle, and it is that plane that I want to view, okay, momentarily. So from that point of view, then on the top, what we see are a bunch of wires where the current is coming out at us. So each of these dots would represent the vector current coming out at us. If we slice and we're looking with our eyeball at this thing, at the bottom, the current is going in to the paper. And we can say that we have a radius R, if you wish. Probably a bad choice, since we'll use R for other things. I don't think it matters. All right, we'll just call it a big R. So is that okay with you? Here's a picture of what we're looking at. So if we look in just that plane and ask what's going on in that plane, then each of these currents up top is going to create a field that is circulating the wire in a counterclockwise fashion. Each of the currents in the bottom is going to create a field that is circulating in a clockwise fashion as you look at it. And what's happening in the world is going to be a superposition of that field produced by all of these wires at one time. So you'll have this sort of thing for the B field, for those wires, and for the ones going into the board, it'll look like this. Okay? When you're thinking solenoid, you can think of the wire spacing being uniform. Generally, you could imagine creating something where that wasn't the case. When people talk about solenoids, that's not really what they mean. So if the wire spacing is uniform, they are all carrying the same current, then you can imagine this current creates a magnetic field at this point, which is going down. This current creates a magnetic field at that point, which is going down, but the transverse components will cancel. So here it will all just be going down. If you think about this one is going to create a field at this point going to the left, this one to the left, that one to the left. So all of these wires are basically going to create a magnetic field that is just going to the left. All of these up here will be creating a magnetic field that's just going to the right when they add together. If you look at what's going up over here, it's the same thing, except now it's going to the right on the bottom and to the left on the top. Okay, by the symmetry of the problem. So to get a sense of what the size and how the distance dependence comes into play, let's imagine drawing an Amperian loop that looks like so. And let's choose a little DS like that. And down here the DS is going to be like this, and over here the DS is going to be like that, and here it'll be like so. And let us ask, what can we learn about the field of the wires that are on the top? Let's only consider those for a moment, and then we'll worry about the bottom and how we add them together. So if you look at the symmetry of the problem, the B field is just going to the left on the top. B dot ds is B times ds. If you look at the sides, ds is going straight down. At least until you get to this very point, actually, the symmetry is all to the left. So you're going to have B dot ds is all going to be B dot ds is 0 because B is perpendicular to ds. B is to the left, ds is down. Same is true over here. Here, B is to the right, ds is to the right, so B dot ds is B times ds, and then you have 0 over here. So if we look at Ampere's law, then the integral of B dot ds around this loop is going to be 2 times B times L, so we'll call this distance for the loop little L, So that would be B dot dx, the sum of this length times B, and I have two of those, so I get 2 times B times L, and that's equal to mu 0 times I enclosed, which is going to be mu 0 times the number of wires per unit length times the current that's being This would be sort of the wire pitch, and it's a quantity that characterizes the solenoid, so you'll be given that typically. So what this means is that B due to the top is equal to 2 times mu 0 times n times I over 2, or mu 0 times n times I, and it does depend on the pitch. But note that it does not depend on the distance that you are from those wires. So this is very similar to what we had when we had an infinite charged plane and we found the electric field didn't care how far away from the plane you were. Again, it was in part that may seem odd, but we had a non-physical situation there with this infinite plane. Here it's the same thing. We have an infinite cylinder. So the field, if I take only the contribution from the wires up top, I have a magnetic field that is constant up here and down here going opposite directions, but it doesn't matter how far from this plane of wires you are. So in fact, if I have a current sheet, that's your answer for the field up top and the field up bottom, if that's all I've got. In this case, I also, in this plane, can think of a current sheet going the other way, and I can do the same game here and calculate the magnetic field at the top and the bottom, and it will have exactly the same magnitude, except in the interior it'll be going to the right, and the exterior it's going to the left. So if you'll notice, the field of the top here extends to infinity. So the top wires here create a magnetic field that's going to the right of this magnitude all the way down to infinity. These do the same thing all the way down to infinity, except the field is going to the left. The magnitudes are the same because the currents and the pitches are the same. So these fields cancel out in the outer region. Same is true up here. In the interior region, the field of this plane and the field of that plane all adds together. So just like what we have at the capacitor, where we have the field infinite for each contributing plane, when we put the planes together, we found they added in the middle and basically superimposed a nothing on the outside. So we have exactly the same sort of game here. So what we find is that B inside is equal to 2 mu 0 n I. I'm sorry. For the top, there's no 2 there. There's the, so it's just 1/2. But now when I add them together, I get mu 0 times n times I. So that would be what you have inside the solenoid, and outside it's equal to 0. So just like with the capacitor, in this case we've created a magnetic field, but it is sort of confined to be in the middle of the solenoid, and it is of uniform and fairly easy to determine strength, which is mu 0 times n times I. Okay? Whereas with the parallel plates, that became our mental representation for capacitor. This will be a reasonable mental picture of what we'll end up calling an inductor. So it'll be, again, a good mental model for something that we use as a circuit element.
think I put most of you to sleep with that one. Let's imagine that we have a table, some sort of tabletop. And on this tabletop, I take a flexible wire, and this flexible wire just lies on top of the table, so it's in two dimensions. And let us imagine that around this wire, there is a current that flows. And so then the question is, what happens as we wait for a minute if this current is fairly powerful? Does the wire just sit there so nothing happens? Does the wire exert forces on itself in such a way that it becomes taut like a circle? Does the wire become taut in some sort of elongated shape? Or does the wire just get all crumpled up so there's something that pulls it in?
Think about it for a moment. Commit to what you think it is. All of those who think it's one, raise your hand. Two, three, four. All right. Good. It's up at the top. You can think of a line segment which will create a magnetic field circling it in such a way that on this side of the wire you'll have a magnetic field that is coming out. Think of a line segment here. You now have a magnetic field that is going up, and you have the current now has come around and it's going that way. So if you have I cross B, gives you a force that's outward on this. B is coming up, I is going that way, I cross B comes out. And you can play that game in different parts of this, and what you'll find is that there will be a force that's pulling the thing out. Okay, so That's what you want. Right.
All right, so now what I want to do is an Ampere's law problem that's one step up in complication, so you get a sense of how these things can go. Let's imagine that we have a coaxial cable that's very long. So if I tell you it's very long, think infinitely long. And otherwise I would tell you it's a finite length, right? I mean, the minute somebody says very long, then it means you can go to the middle and assume it's infinitely long and make do. All right, so boy, that didn't work. So we'll imagine that we have a coaxial cable, and on the interior piece I have a total current I that is flowing, and on the exterior piece I have the same current, but it's flowing the opposite way. And if I take this and I draw it in a different way, I try to do that better. Hmm. I don't know if it's worth it. Probably I should just scribble it and you can figure it out later. All right, so those are meant to be concentric circles. So we're looking at an edge end on here, and we have a radius little a, little b, and little c. And the current here is coming out at you, and the current here is going in terms of the total. And we will say that the current density in the regions where it's flowing is uniform. So let's say that we assume I is uniform across inner and outer conductors. So what I mean by that, maybe isn't said perfectly, is that if I look at the amount of I per bit of surface area where it's flowing, that I per area is going to be constant. So the current density on the inner conductor is all uniform. The current density on the outer conductor is all uniform. Note that the currents are the same and the outer conductor cross-sectional area is bigger, so the current density is going to be less on the outer. I'm not saying that they're the same. Okay? So then the problem that you're given is to find the magnetic field in all space. Okay? So to do this problem, it's very similar to a Gauss's law problem. The first thing you do is you look at the problem and you satisfy yourself that the symmetry is such that it would be good to do with Ampere's law. And in this case, we have no angular dependence. We have a cylindrically symmetric problem. So you're clearly going to have a magnetic field that, where there is a magnetic field, is going to be rotating one way or another around the circular coaxial pieces of this device. And that means that if you choose Amperean loops that are also coaxial, then you'll have B dot Vs that will be simpler. It will be B times Ds. So that's what we'd like to do, is we want to choose now, but we have to choose the regions of space that we want. So let us choose R less than A, so we're in the interior piece. We'd like to calculate the magnetic field at some arbitrary R that satisfies this. So to do that, let's choose an Amperean loop here that has a radius little r. So the Amperean loop is inside. And if I is coming out at you and the Amperean loop only cares about the enclosed field inside, then what it means is the magnetic field for that enclosed field will all be circulating counterclockwise as far as your eye is concerned. So B dot ds is B times ds, and B pulls out of the integral, and you have an integral of ds, which is just 2 pi r for the radius of that thing. So this becomes B times 2 pi r is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. So in this case, it's the I enclosed that you have to stop and think about. What you know is you know the total current, and you know the cross-sectional area of this thing, and you're told that the current density is uniform. So we define a new symbol, which we call J, as a function of R. And this is going to be defined as the current density. And it is an area density. And in this particular problem, we have said that it is constant. If I wanted to give you the same exact problem, but add a wrinkle, I would tell you the current density is some function of R, okay? So in this case, because it is constant, the current density as a function of R is going to be the total current I divided by the area of that inner conductor, which is pi times A squared. So Ampere's law then becomes B times 2 pi R is equal to this is the inner conductor, this is the radius A, this has a radius little r. If we know the current density, then we take the current density and we multiply it by the area of this piece, and that would be the amount of current that's enclosed inside the Amperian loop. So this is equal to J of R times the area of the Amperian loop, which is going to be pi r squared, which is equal to I over, we'll have pi r squared over pi a squared. So that means B is equal to I times R over pi A squared, and am I missing a factor two? I'm sorry?
The mu disappeared as well.
Yeah. It did, didn't it? I'll fix that. I'm wondering about the factor two.
Divide by two. You just didn't divide.
Oh, that's I'm sorry. I'm using my notes to make sure I don't screw up, but then what happens is as I'm thinking through it and I'm looking at my notes, if I look at the wrong place in my notes, I get screwed up. So I don't know. It's not pretty. Okay, so there's a mu which I drop. So I should have mu zero times I enclosed. So there's a mu zero here. There's a mu zero here. So there's a mu zero here. It should be mu zero times I times R over 2 pi A squared. There is a factor 2 in here. And no, I already have that. Okay. It's a vector. So if you look at the current coming out at us, we'll say that it's counterclockwise. There are different ways in which you can specify the direction, and
so you just have to specify the direction. If you say you could say, okay, the magnitude of this, and then say counterclockwise or something like that. But you have to also give direction. If you ask B is a vector, you're going to get it off.
You okay with that? Okay. So. Same problem, we're asked to do it in all space, so what we've done is for R less than A, now what I'd like to do is to look at the region between B and C, so this region, so B is less than R is less than C, and so in that region I would draw the Amperian loop in here with a radius R. the integral of b dot ds is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. This is going to be b times 2 pi r for all the same arguments we've already had. In this case, it's just mu 0 times I, because you have only that one current that's going through.
You're not, yeah, are you talking about A to B or B to C?
Very good. You are awake. Anything else? Okay, good. Thank you. So B here is equal to mu 0 times I over 2 pi r. And again, you have to specify the direction. In this case, it's going to be counterclockwise. I want you to notice something, that we are outside of this extended current. Mu 0 I over 2 pi r. If we were to imagine that current all being in an infinite line, we would get B as mu 0 I over 2 pi r. Direction's the same, magnitude's the same. So just like what happens with an extended spherically symmetric charge distribution, if you're outside of that charge distribution, it doesn't even have to be spherically symmetric. Well, I guess it does if you're getting Gauss's law. So if you have a spherically symmetric extended charge distribution, when you are outside of it, it looks as if all the field of a point charge all at the origin. So here it's the same thing. We can have an extended current that is radially symmetric and cylindrically symmetric. If you're outside of that, it looks just like a line current in terms of how the field is. Okay. So now I want to look at the next region out, which is going to be this region of space. So now I'm looking at R, which is going to be less than C and greater than B this time. All right. Same game, same symmetry, except now if you look at the current that's enclosed, we have to integrate the charge density. First of all, we have this current that you can't forget. And then you have going the opposite direction, so it comes in with a different sign. We have to integrate the current density over this interior region. I did not say the whole thing, right? Because this piece is not inside that loop. Also, the current density in the outer is a little different. So J of R in the outer conductor, or the outer shell, I'll call it a conductor. I've specified how the current's flowing. It's going to come in, we have to put in a minus sign because it's going the opposite direction. It'll be the total current I, and now we have to get the area, and the area is going to be the area of this circle, which is pi b squared. I'm sorry, the area of this circle, the big one, pi c squared, minus the area of the smaller circle, pi b squared. Okay? So the I, which is enclosed in the outer conductor. So for the moment, I'm going to forget this current just because I don't want to carry around the term for a moment. I'd like to just calculate that. That will be minus I, it'll be the current density. Times the area that is inside little r. So it'll be this area. Which will be pi r squared minus pi b squared. Okay? So B dot ds is equal to mu 0 times I enclosed. The left-hand side, again, because of the symmetry of the problem, is simple. B times 2 pi r. The right-hand side is mu 0 times I enclosed. So I have to include the I for the inner conductor and then subtract from it the I from the outer conductor, which is minus I and fractionally you have a full I here which is coming out at you, which gives you a counterclockwise. And then inside, you have an I going out, but you have less of it here. I've defined sort of the signs in such a way that the B is counterclockwise if this is positive coming out of you. If in fact, because the field is falling off as you go out and R here, and you have a field here which is effectively created closer, it's not completely obvious to me which way it's gonna go. Probably geometrically you can figure that out easily enough. But you can bear in mind that if I say that this is, if I pull the 2 pi R down and I say this is B going counterclockwise, if this term dominates, it gets a negative sign, which means it's going the other way. All right, so that one is a little complicated, but okay. You good? And the last piece is outside of this entire thing. So I choose my Amperian loop here in the last region outside. So this would be R greater than C. And in this case, you can look at it, and you have a current coming out at you, I. You have a current going in, which is I. Opposite directions cancel out. Total current through this loop is 0, so B is 0. And that is one of the reasons why people like coaxial cables. Because you can confine the magnetic field to be inside the thing and it doesn't bleed outside. If you just have a bare wire, you've got a magnetic field that's outside. Okay? So one reason that might bother you is, if you recall, when we looked at electric fields, we found that they have energy in them. So we calculated the energy density in an electric field because it's E squared. We will shortly do the same thing for the magnetic field and find that the magnetic field also has energy in it, and it goes as B squared. So if I have a wire and I have to establish a magnetic field over all space, then it's going to take more energy than it does if I effectively confine it. Certain space. So that's one thing. The other thing is that we'll find that magnetic fields that bleed into other parts of the circuit can be problematic, which is pretty much what we're going to talk about in a minute. So any questions on this? No?
All right, so that's the end of material for exam two. It's just through Ampere's law. So there'll be some Ampere law homework. There's, I think, at least one Ampere's law homework problem on your assignment for this week. And I think there's a workshop problem or two that you'll use for Ampere's law. Having tackled Gauss's law, you know, it's usually okay. The kinds of mistakes that are commonly done would be, for example, you're calculating the current density in the region of that outer conductor, and you look at the enclosed current and you use the wrong radius.
So a common thing to do would be mistakenly putting C squared here or something like that. So just using the wrong, just getting mixed up that way. So a lot of the same sorts of thinking that you did with Gauss's law, you want to do, be careful with your bookkeeping here. But on the scale of things, having tackled Gauss's law, I think it's not too bad. So you good with that? All right, so what I would like to do now is to start to look at what I think of as probably one of the coolest topics of physics, actually, in terms of its implications. It's called magnetic induction. And what I have is a coil of wire. The ends are connected to the two poles of a voltmeter. The big honking ancient voltmeter. So, can you all see it? So what happens with this is if I put a battery across this, then I'll just get a reading. If I flip the battery around, the reading will go the other way. So if it's a 1.5 volt battery DC, it'll just read 1.5 volts. Okay, so that's all this is, the voltmeter. But I have a common matter. Look at what happens if I just do that. I do it slowly. Not much happens. I go fast, and a lot. I flip it around. And I go fast now the other way, if you were paying attention, it went that way a moment ago. So if I take it with this pole, with the tape on it inside, and I pull it out, it goes like that. Take the other pole, pull it out, it goes like that. Okay? I have a more powerful magnet. And it goes crazy. But if I go slowly, it doesn't do much. If I go fast, it goes crazy. So, what do we have? We have a magnetic field that's, say, coming out here. So what I'm doing is I am increasing the magnetic field going through the loop when I push through, okay? If I increase it fast, I get a voltage induced. If I pull it out the other way fast, I get a voltage induced the other direction, okay? If I do it out here, it's not nearly as excited about it. Okay. So what we say is that if I have a changing magnetic field, which is what I get if I shove a pole of a magnet through here, the rate is important because if I move it very slowly, I have a changing magnetic field, but not very fast. So not much is happening. Move it fast, then I get a big change. So clearly, if I have a changing magnetic field, the rate of change of the magnetic field in this loop actually will induce
a volt in this loop. If I induce a voltage in the loop, what does it really mean is happening in this loop? The loop of wire is just sitting there. And what I'm saying is if I move a charge all the way around and come back to the same point, it took work. For that to happen, there better have been an electric field in that wire. But that's the thing that induces the voltage. That's what gives you the voltage. So a changing magnetic field induces an electric field. Okay? And that's what we call magnetic induction.
So this was Michael Faraday in England and Joseph Henry in the U.S. So we'll look at other setups like this, but you can take a current loop, and I can take this current loop and I can put it across an EMF, and let's suppose this EMF is
a little generator that produces a current, an electric field in the wire, a current in the wire, a voltage in the wire that oscillates sinusoidally.
So I'll do that by giving it a little wiggle. So what that means is you will have a current that builds, rotates one way and then goes the other way. And if you imagine now what's happening with the magnetic field, here's my current loop. I have a current that's building and going this way. That will give me a magnetic field in the interior that is growing, going out. And then that current will slow down to nothing. I'll have no magnetic field. And then the current will rotate the other way, and I'll have a magnetic field going this way. So it's a way of building something that basically creates a varying magnetic field. So the magnetic field will be varying sinusoidally. And I can take another coil over here. And hook it up to an ammeter. And what you're going to find is because I have a varying magnetic field that's changing in magnitude and direction caused by one loop, through this other loop, it'll induce a current that will also change. Yeah?
So if we have a magnet that's oscillating at high speeds, it'll induce an alternating current through the wire?
It's what a generator does. I mean, if you take a loop of wire and you hook it to an axis and you have a magnet here and you rotate it, it creates an AC current in the wire. Right, that's what a generator is. And one of the reasons you do AC is because it's easy to do. It's easy to make. You take this and you hook it up to paddles that are in a waterfall and you're good. You have an AC current. DC is a little harder.
That's just the start of the implications of this. I'm trying hard not to sort of pop bubbles for later classes too much right now. This phenomenon is totally cool. It leads to all sorts of fun stuff. Okay, so induction. If we have magnetostatics, then we have magnetic fields, they are not changing. They don't screw around with the voltages in anything. They don't change. So in this case, if you do Kirchhoff, then the sum of the voltages around any loop that you do has to be equal to zero. Or another way to say that is
E dot dl summed around the loop has to be zero. Right? If the electric field along that loop has any net component, then if I take a charge, I'm going to have some net work that it takes to go around that loop. So in a magnetostatic situation, that is always zero.
If you have a situation where you may have a changing B field, which is a situation where you may have a changing current or something like that, then we have what is called an induced EMF. Which you can measure by doing going around and measuring this quantity E dot dl around the loop. And as I hope I motivated for you there, this is going to be equal to the rate of change of the magnetic flux through the loop. So you can think of the loops subtending a surface which has little dAs or n hat times dAs. And if you ask how much magnetic field flux goes through that loop, you calculate it just like an electric flux through the loop, except you use an E. And as you saw, I can have a lot of magnetic flux going through this circuit or this loop, and it does nothing. Right? If I move this in slowly and it's just sitting there, there's a lot of magnetic flux going, but it's doing that. It's when I change it. And the direction and rate of change are important in terms of inducing this loop, this voltage. So what it says is, even though I don't have a battery sitting in this loop, if I were now to do a sum around this loop, it would take work to go around because there's a net electric field along that loop in some sense that you get because of this changing magnetic field. One of the cool things about this is that it doesn't matter whether that loop of wire is there or not. If I have a changing magnetic flux in space and I have a charge that I want to move around in the loop, it will take work. It's as if there were a wire there with a voltage on it. And that EMF that is induced in space, it goes as minus d phi over dt. Okay? And that's probably a good place to start. And Tuesday we'll come back and start playing more with this. It's really cool stuff, so we'll have fun with it. Thank you.